We gotta go through this shit show.
What is this, your first day? I give you something about starting the show and you're like, oh, what a shit show. Like, what?
No, we gotta go through this shit show.
Hello. I'm Pedro.
And I'm Meredith.
And this is Gritty Reboot, the grittiest show about reboots there has ever been. We had a terrible start to the show. I just kicked my wife just to keep you in line. All right. She was talking during the song. It's all off to a bad start. And then the worst part of it is we have to cover Death Wish 2018.
Yeah.
The most insignificant and dumb movie.
That's why I'm grumbling.
Oh, God. The only movie that can make Death Wish 1974 feel like a masterpiece. It really does. Like, Death Wish 74, I look back and I'm like, oh, the days of Bronson. That was fun last week watching that Bronson movie.
Yeah, like, we were shitting all over the Bronson movie.
Yeah, and then, like,
now we watched this movie and we're like, that movie.
Yeah, 10 minutes into this movie, I was like, no, I want Bronson back again. I would take some of the Death Wish sequels. Listen, I think I might take all the Death Wish sequels, because there's a camp value to them that this movie doesn't even have.
Mm-mm.
And that's the one thing I have to stress about it.
No joy will be had.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about Eli Roth's version of this movie, is that it is a really joyless affair.
I couldn't even get into the gory scenes.
Yeah, and there is some nice gore. There's a few nice things about the film, and that's one of them. The head squish, brake fluid bit. That gore is all, I think, fairly well done.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks pretty cool. There's, at the end of the movie, one of the thugs is knocked off the stairs and his head hits the ground, yeah. His neck snaps. That looked pretty gnarly. So there are a few things like that I did enjoy about the movie. But I think, like, the thing about this movie, as much as I know, like, a lot of, like, gun enthusiasts really champion this movie, this is such a dickless film. Right?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have the balls to be, like, controversial and be, you know, maybe either A, inflammatory, B, actually offensive, or C, just exploitative. It's just none of those things. It's like a safe corporatized version of a Death Wish that's okay to be released in theaters in the late 2010s.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And it's nothing more than that. It's just a safe for work version of what this idea initially is. Because it doesn't have any of what the poignancy the book was supposed to have. It doesn't even have any of the slight nuance that was in the original film. And I'm not talking about it like it's the fucking Godfather. It's a Charles Bronson movie, for fuck's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie doesn't even really have that to go along with it. It just has a few snazzy shots by director Eli Roth. And that's about it. And honestly, one of the worst performances from Bruce Willis. And about Bruce Willis, I guess we should talk about the thing. Like, he obviously had the early stages of dementia. We don't know when that began to affect him, but we do know he had been turning in performances for a long time before he had. Like, we don't know when the diagnosis came, but he had been turning in performances for a while.
Yeah.
So as it comes for, like, criticism, like, could that have affected him? Possibly. But, you know, I mean, he was dead in movies in Die Hard, you know, 4 or 5 years earlier. And I think that's just how Bruce Willis was at that point.
Yeah.
So, and be that as it may, this is an incredibly weak and bland performance from Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
In a movie that was the one thing this film needed, was a lift over Charles Bronson. You know, someone who was a real actor. And they picked the only person who could deliver a stiffer performance than old Charlie Bronson in 1974.
I'll go through the roles of the actors that would have been Paul Kersey in this movie.
As you should. This movie had quite an interesting production, to say the least. But before I get to anything, there's a little game I wanted to play. So I put together, since we are nostalgic for last week and Charlie Bronson, I want to play some clips. These are death lines. These are lines after wishes of death have been fulfilled by one Charles Bronson. And I want you to tell me which installment they are from. Don't forget, there are 5 Death Wish films.
You believe in Jesus?
Yes, I do.
Well, you're going to meet him.
Now, this is a religious Charles Bronson. Does this sound like an earlier Death Wish 1, Death Wish 2 Bronson? Or is this a later, seasoned, seen the Lord, Death Wish 5, the face of death Bronson?
going to go Death Wish 3.
You're going to go Death Wish. Is that your final answer?
That's my final answer.
The answer is Death Wish 2. Death Wish 2. This is probably the most famous kill from Death Wish 2. All right. Hey.
What's the problem?
What?
With the car. What's the problem?
Just get out of my fucking face. Who are you?
We're still in the fucking car. What's it to you? It's my car.
Now you're going to die.
Now, is this my car comment? Is this a mid Charles Bronson in the franchise? Or is this a young Bronson? How do you feel? He's thinking. He's contemplating. Does she feel the age in his voice?
I'm going to say 5.
You're going to say 5. The face of death, which is incorrect. It's Death Wish 3, which doesn't have a subtitle.
I'm terrible at this game.
I don't think it does. We will do one more.
Wait!
Listen.
It's a long clip.
You want whatever you need. I don't need anything. But you need a bath.
For context, Charles Bronson just kicked a man into a vat of acid. Rick and Morty were not in that vat of acid.
Wow.
So, with that being said, how do you feel? Is this that doesn't feel very early Death Wish, does it?
No, I'm going to go number 4.
Number 4. And with that, my co-host has been fired. You're out of the game. That was Death Wish 5. That was him killing Michael Parks, beloved character actor Michael Parks, who actually has a lot of fun in that movie. I don't recommend Death Wish 5, but I do recommend it over Death Wish 2018.
Have I told you I love you?
Yes, Dad, you've told me like a billion times.
Honey? Can you please come down here? No. Joy, run!
So like we said, gentlemen and ladies, in the year of our Lord 2018, we were blessed with Dean Norris, Elizabeth Shue, Camilla Morone, Vincent D'Onofrio, and Bruce Willis in Death Wish.
Yep.
Directed by Eli Roth, who... How do you feel about Eli Roth?
Eh. You know.
I think that summed it up. Eh.
Yeah. You know, I like Cabin Fever.
I like some of Ross' work. I'm not always enamored with it. I don't think he's a great director, but I think he's a good one. I think he's just a good director. And I think a movie like this was in his wheelhouse, and it just, you know, whatever it was got away from him.
Yeah.
Whatever it was got away from him. So
he should have been more exploitative about it.
So I want to ask, had you seen this beforehand?
The 2018
version? Yeah, this version.
No.
You'd only seen, okay, yeah. I know my dad loved Death Wish, the original film, and he didn't even want to see this in the theater when it came out. So I had no real incentive to ever see it. And I think I just checked it out. I might have rented it off of Redbox or something like that because I was kind of curious how bad it was. And I wasn't enamored when I saw it. But I don't really remember a thing about it, honestly. So as we talked about last week's, I remembered it being underwhelming. And rewatching it was way worse than I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Way worse than I remembered. I can't really stress that enough. And
it was pretty bad.
I want to talk a little bit about where the movie came from. Obviously, it's a remake, but initially the film came to life from Sylvester Stallone kind of batting the idea around in the mid-'00s, 2006, kind of talking about wanting to do a Death Wish film. And it kind of bounced around. And eventually, like, you know, 4 or 5 years later, he was kind of beyond it and done with it. And then really it sort of gets in the hands of Joe Carnahan, who does eventually take writing credit for the film, but he does develop a Death Wish script that is pretty well regarded around Hollywood, apparently. That's one people like, and it's not the one that we're going to end up seeing in this film. It's similar, but it's not what we ended up getting. And he had Liam Neeson more in mind for that kind of part. And, you know, as movies do, they kind of get kicked around or whatever, and Bruce Willis ends up coming onto the project later on. And he has creative differences with Mr. Carnahan, and Carnahan moves on, eventually has some pretty nasty and veiled things to say about an aging action star taking over the role and pussifying it, I think is kind of how he put it. And whatever edge Carnahan might have put on the script, and Carnahan did The Gray and Smoking Aces. I think he's a pretty solid writer and director. Whatever he might have had or whatever interested him in the project, obviously a lot of that wasn't in that final script. Even though he does take sole writing credit on, I do know there were other writers that were brought on when Eli Roth came along to the project.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bruce Willis was being a baby about the film, and he didn't want the script to be rewritten, even though some elements had to be changed in order for the film to get the funding and to actually get released and made. So Eli Roth, once like a director of some note came along, then I think Willis kind of relented. And then we got this version of the film, which is underwhelming, as we said.
Yeah.
With that, that's sort of how we came into this. And I think the other notable aspect is that this movie comes out early 2018, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be released at the end of 2016, correct?
Sure.
Yes, she agrees. So this film was delayed for like a year and a half because, you know, a movie about a vigilante doesn't really play well when there's been a shooting. And the fact is, and a sad fact of America, is that there were so many shootings that this film just kind of kept getting knocked back and knocked back and knocked back until eventually they just sort of dumped it. And eventually when they did dump the movie, there actually was a shooting at a college, I think three or four days before the movie opened, or maybe the day before the movie opened. And I mean, it's a sad state about America. And, you know, the movie just, even if it would have had a fair chance at the box office, things like that would have killed it. It probably wasn't the best time to make a Death Wish movie.
I just realized that we haven't had a school shooting or any kind of shooting in a while, at least not that's been publicized. And that scares the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Right?
You think they're just like kept under the rug now? Like they just don't make big news unless they
not just that. Like we're due.
Like, oh, we're due?
Yeah.
Like there's going to be like a big one? You think it's like an earthquake system is how school shootings work?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know.
I got to get the stats on that. I'm cutting that whole part out of the show. And anyway, back to school shooter roundup with Meredith and Pedro. Maybe I'll cut that part too.
I'm glad I could bring the intensity.
Yeah. I'm glad you did. Do you want to talk about more school shooters? Do you have any Dilly Glee Bulb thoughts?
No.
All right, great.
We're good.
All right.
Let's do it. Death Wish.
All right, how's this movie start?
It starts with a view of the city and news about violence and police radio.
And what city is that?
Chicago.
It is Chicago. Yes, it is Chicago. You don't say like a question. Just shout them out when you know them. It's fine. Yeah, it's Chicago. And that's a big deal because like in American news lore, Chicago is like this battleground. And yes, Chicago is a violent city, but a lot of cities are violent.
Yeah.
You know, Chicago, I don't think is even the murder capital of the United States.
Like there was Baltimore.
Yeah, I think, I don't even know what it is. I probably should have looked it up, but I know there are other cities that rank a little bit higher. But I'm not saying Chicago isn't violent, but it's a place that's focused on a lot.
A cop has been shot and his partner races to the hospital. They look for Dr. Kersey, who is a trauma surgeon. He's a trauma surgeon in this movie instead of an architect.
He is. So if you thought Charles Bronson was unbelievable as an architect, let me show you Bruce Willis trying to be a surgeon.
Yeah.
Because this is just out of his wheelhouse. Elizabeth Shue is in this movie, which reminds me that she plays like a nuclear physicist in The Saint. And it is the role she cannot do.
Man.
The technical jargon just dies coming out of her mouth. It's almost as bad as Denise Richards in The World's Not Enough. But this just doesn't work at all. By the way, when we came into the movie, as we had shots over Chicago, I don't know why I'm talking my hand so much, but you guys can't see that at all. They introduced the DJs, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to have Mancow, Sway, and another guy who I can't remember off the top of my head. And these guys are going to basically recap the night's events and sort of talk about it. Well, I don't think it's a bad idea to do this. Personally, I have never been the biggest fan of this technique. And I kind of criticized it the other day when we were watching Man of Steel and Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
That movie, a lot of narrative was revealed. Like we hear like news reporters talking about the events that just occurred.
You know, I knew I was in for a bad movie when we get our Dr. Kersey here going to his first patient we see him with. And like they're coding and he doesn't do anything.
Yeah. So
it's just like, all right, I'm going to let this guy die.
Bruce Willis is just sleepwalking
through
this film and it never picks up. There's maybe two or three times in the movie where he shows some life, and I'll point them out when we get to them.
He just lets the patient die.
Here's the thing, like, because of Bruce Willis's performance, I can't tell what kind of guy Kersey is. I just can't, because I don't know if he's indifferent or just negligent as a surgeon at this point. I really can't. I have no idea. But yeah, he sort of lets this guy go after like 10 seconds, right?
Yeah.
He's like, well,
try CPR, heart stop,
fuck it, let's get out of here.
Nothing. And everybody's just like, okay with it.
Yeah. It's an odd thing. Like, if you've watched a lot of medical dramas, like, that's my only experience to medicine besides being sick myself, is that, you know, in that situation, there's like a level sense of urgency. And then, like, you have the paddles, you try CPR, you do the mask and the breath, and they don't do any of that. It's just super weird. He's like, yeah, well, I got shit to do. Let's get to the title card.
Well, like we talked about earlier, Elizabeth Shue is the wife, which I love Elizabeth Shue, so I'm glad she's in this movie.
Oh, by the way, right at the title card, we get one of the conflicts in the film, which is he's going to leave the officer dead, and he's now going to go work on the shooter.
Yeah.
And I think the officer even calls him out. You're going to go work on the animal that shot my partner? You know, Bruce Willis is like, I'll save him if I can. You know, barely alive. walking away from the action. But that sort of sets up our internal conflict. Like, Kersey's, I guess, supposed to be like a liberal pussy is the idea of who he is.
Yeah, I guess.
A real man, he would have done everything to save that police officer, and then he would have pissed in that shooter's wounds. That's what a real man would. I don't know what the movie trying to say.
Messaging is all.
Yeah, there's times I'm like, well, what's Roth trying to say here? Because that's the thing. I don't think Roth is trying to say anything. I don't think Roth really cares one way or the other. I think Roth likes guns, but he's like, yeah, but they're problematic. I think Roth is kind of in the middle, so he doesn't really have a take. He's just like, I think it'd be fun to make a Death Wish movie. And then he got there and like he got grumpy Bruce Willis instead of like fun Charlie Bronson.
Yeah.
And so he's like, well, I'll make the best of it. And he didn't even really pull that off. But that's the weird thing. I don't think this movie really has a ton of politics to it, despite a lot of people reading that into it.
The Kersey family have breakfast together. They end up celebrating a little bit because their daughter got into the university in New York that she wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. She gets an NYU. And by the way, that's played by Camilla Marone. She's kind of most famously known as like one of Leonardo DiCaprio's girlfriends.
Yeah.
Dumped when she was 25, before she got to 25. And she's actually pretty solid here. She's one of the movie's better performances. I just wanted to mention that right now and just highlight her. I think she does a really nice job in a very small part.
Mm-hmm.
And also Elizabeth Shue in very small work. I think it's pretty solid here.
Yeah.
It's very noticeable because as she comes downstairs, very excited about coming to NYU, like Bruce Willis is just like, nice. He could barely be bothered to care that his daughter has gotten into the university of her choice.
Terrible.
Yeah. Willis is just barely alive.
They're at a soccer game and one of the dads starts cussing and causing trouble. He's yelling at his daughter and calling people pussies.
Yeah, he's being the nightmare dad in this situation. From a guy who goes to a lot of high school sporting events, I see this every now and then. It's usually quieted down pretty quickly. And, you know, it's not certainly tolerated like how this guy would have done it. This guy is sort of like this weird straw man argument just so the movie can kind of exist.
What is the purpose of this?
I think the problem with this scene is Willis tries to kind of be a little quippy with him, you know, kind of give some smirks, but his performance is so it's so subdued, I guess, if I'm being very nice. It's so not there that I can't really tell what Kersey's purpose is, if he's trying to antagonize him, if he's really trying to settle him down, if he's trying to be friendly. I can't tell. I really can't. That's how bland Bruce Willis is in this movie.
Yeah, there's no emotion coming from him.
And this guy is just a dick for no particular reason about it. And Elizabeth Shue has to save him or, you know, make sure there isn't a fight.
Yeah. You know, they get in a fight. He leaves, blah, blah, blah. Vincent and Alfredo is having dinner with the Kerseys. They're celebrating, you know, the daughter getting into college.
They're celebrating and they're happy about her soccer game. Frank. And they recap him on the fight earlier.
Yeah.
And he said he should have thrown down with the guy. By the way, what are they eating? Deep dish pizza. So, you know, it's Chicago.
Oh.
They're not in Montreal. No, they're in Chicago.
I didn't notice what they were eating.
Oh, yeah, because I was like, this movie's going to do everything it can to convince me that they're going to be in Chicago when I goddamn well know they're in fucking Vancouver.
Deep dish pizza, baby.
And that's all I learned is like Bruce Willis only went one day to Chicago. And that's where he was like riding the L train. That was it. That's all they shot in Chicago. Well, there were a few more exterior shots, but that's all Bruce Willis shot there.
Wow.
Wow.
D'Onofrio is excellent in this movie, actually.
Yeah, I mean, he's always very good in a movie.
He's asking his brother for money, but he doesn't even ask for the money. He subtly hints at it with some good performance.
Yeah, and this is one of the few times Willis kind of comes alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a little nice back and forth with D'Onofrio. And I didn't realize these guys have known each other since they were like 19 or 20.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, they worked at a bar together in L.A. And D'Onofrio was the bouncer. I think Willis was the bartender. So, yeah, these guys have known each other for a very long time.
Wow.
Yeah, they really have. They've worked together for a number of years. So when their relationship kind of comes through a little bit, and it doesn't in every scene, but it does in this one.
Yeah.
And it really helps. You would think the movie can kind of write itself at this point, but trouble is a brewing.
Yeah, the first minority character we're introduced to is a criminal.
Yeah, the first minority who shows up is a criminal.
Yeah.
Coincidence? Probably. But we're introduced, what's his, Manuel, I think?
Yeah.
MJ, because he's drawn attention to because it's, you're a fan of the Bulls? Because, hey, it's Chicago. But the MJ is just, I guess, his initials. Who tattoos their initials on their arm?
Yeah, who does that?
It's kind of a strange thing.
Yeah. I would never do that.
Yeah, I don't know who really does that. But hey, it's whatever. It's his body. He can do what he wants.
So he ends up eventually swiping the Kersey's address from their...
Yeah, he overhears them talking about how it's going to be Paul's birthday coming up. Yeah. So he's going to be out of the house. So he snaps the picture and sends this off to his criminal buddies, or as we're led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to the next scene.
Yep. Next scene is they're at home. They're about to celebrate his birthday because it's his birthday.
Yeah, they're about to ready to go out.
Paul gets pulled away from work.
Yeah, he's on call because he's a surgeon. Remember, they introduced that. He's the most believable surgeon in the world.
And then Lucy, who is Elizabeth Shue's character, who I'm going to refer to as Lucy moving forward, is making a cake. And
tres leches.
She notices a breeze.
She notices a breeze. Someone has farted.
I shut that window.
Yes, she's very sure. And this scene in itself isn't bad. I kind of like her slowly walking around the house to realize that someone else is in the house.
Yeah, she sees footprints.
Yeah, when Bruce Willis is away, the movie has its strongest scene out of nowhere. What a surprise. But yeah, I like this, especially I even enjoyed the daughter upstairs. Like, Mom, I will come downstairs in a minute.
Yeah, because she's like...
she's on her phone. She's looking for her mom's tablet.
I forget the daughter's name in this movie.
Abigail.
You don't know.
No, I just made that up. Sorry. I knew the actress's name, but I did not know the actual name.
Well, she calls her daughter to come downstairs, and she's just...
Jordan.
Jordan. She's getting more and more
named after Michael impatient. Jordan, Chicago.
Yeah. Huh?
All right, sorry, continue.
And she's getting more and more impatient, and...
More and more insistent, yeah.
Yeah, because she sees the footprints. She sees the
footprints.
She knows something's wrong.
Yeah.
She has this is that well feeling.
Done. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she gets attacked, and so does the daughter. And she's forced to open the safe.
And this is initially a much more calm and cordial attack than what we saw in the 1974 film.
Yeah, the daughter gets molested, but nothing more.
Yeah, she isn't assaulted. The guy attempts to grope her, and that's about all that really is done. They want to keep it professional, and that's what happens. One of them tries to sort of run his hands up the daughter's thigh, and the other one's like, hey, listen, that's not the kind of business we're here for. They're really just trying to steal the money.
Yeah. The daughter ends up slashing one of the criminals' faces. And then the mother puts grease all over the other.
She was boiling the water.
Is it boiling water?
Yeah, she was boiling water.
I thought it was grease.
Yeah. You wanted this, the whole movie, like you were like, where's the guy with the burnt face? I was like, it was just boiling water. Like she didn't throw
like a vat. That's fucking hot.
She didn't put him in an acid bath like Charlie Bronson.
Okay, I'm going to throw boiling water on you and see how you feel about
it. Well, I'm not going to feel great about it, but
see what happens afterwards.
But like my face wouldn't melt off is what, that wouldn't happen. It would just be very hot.
Uh-huh.
Would hurt.
Yeah, you'd be fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, but it wouldn't, you know, I think you expected him to have like a melted face is what you wanted. Like he thought he was going to show up like the guy at the end of RoboCop.
No, but I expected it to look like.
Yeah, because he doesn't have much of a payoff. We're getting way ahead of ourselves. Yeah, he only has the scar is the main thing, but he gets that because he's screwing around. The daughter tries to defend herself. That's exactly why the other bad guy, the other robber wanted to make sure they actually were playing it safe.
And we're back with Bruce Willis. We're with Paul, and he hears a female girl and a woman are brought into the trauma unit.
So we don't Okay, so this movie doesn't have a rape, which is fine. I don't care about that one way or the other. But we don't see the gunshot, right?
No.
We do not see the gunshot. We cut to the outside of the house for two gunshots, and then we come in here to Kersey. And I think that's something that's very different.
Is this movie rated R or PG-13?
See, that's not a great sign. It is rated R. It is rated R.
But why didn't we see the killing?
I think they wanted to keep it classy here. You know, Eli Roth's not a guy who wants to pull his punches here, but I think he just wanted to leave that up to the audience's imagination. And I think that's a little bit different than what we saw in the first movie. And I don't think that's necessarily a great change. And I mean, I don't necessarily appreciate the brutal rape scene, but it has a purpose, you know?
Yeah.
It has a purpose in the original film.
He finds out eventually that it's his wife and daughter, and they're the victims of a horrible, horrible crime.
So there's only one hospital in Chicago.
There's only one.
Yeah, because he, and by the way, this is the world's most convenient hospital, because literally all the plot is going to wander into Bruce Willis in this hospital as the movie goes on. We'll talk about it as we get there, but like literally the plot just wanders into his hospital. Like that's just the way the screenplay is formatted. So he's in some sort of hospital in downtown Chicago, but still his family from the suburbs comes all the way there. He's able to discover that Elizabeth Shue is dead and his daughter is in surgery. And he has a stiff scene with a dead Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah. And then the cops talk to him and Uncle Frank, and he starts freaking out on the cops.
Uncle Frank does.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis is, once again,
wooden.
DOA.
He's just a mannequin.
All you can hear is the dial-up noise going on in his head. There's nobody home. Yeah. Bruce Willis couldn't be bothered to care about this situation. Detective played by Dean Norris, by the way, from Breaking Bad.
So the daughter's in a coma. And then we have the funeral for Lucy,
which is back in Texas. Which, where she's from, she mentions it earlier in the soccer scene.
It's supposed to be all sad and shit.
It is supposed to be all sad and shit. This is supposed to be a parallel for the trip to Arizona, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because Bruce's father-in-law puts the idea in his head that guns are the answer to all of his problems.
Yeah.
And
he has this whole, like, right-wing, like, pro-gun.
Yeah, he gives this whole speech where a man's got to defend what's his, and he can only do that with a gun. I mean, that's fine. This scene is okay, but it is marred by the fact that Bruce Willis looks like he could barely be bothered to be in costume.
Yeah.
Scene. I mean, really, this is where I thought the movie would excel, and it just doesn't, because this is the part where Bronson could barely show us that he was affected by what was going on, but he could. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Willis can't get across any emotion that isn't him sort of smirking at the camera, because that's the only thing he's going to be good at, is smirking at D'Onofrio or smirking at Elizabeth Shue or smirking at the camera later on with the therapist.
Yeah.
It's the only thing he really still has left in the bag at this point. So any conflict of him trying to think about what's going on, it's just nothing. He's just staring blankly at this character as he makes his speech about the guns.
Next day, Paul is rude to a homeless man who cleans his windshield.
Yeah, so we come into Paul being a dickhead.
Mm-hmm.
He's being rude to Dean Norris on the phone because I understand he wants results from an investigation, but I think anybody who's ever dealt with police knows that kind of shit takes time. And then he's also being rude to a homeless guy cleaning his window for no reason.
Yeah. He's back at the hospital and his daughter's friend is there and she's reading the textbook for the school that they were going to attend together.
Yeah.
So whatever.
This is not a bad scene.
It's a whatever.
It's fine. Yeah. The movie has a lot of bad scenes. This isn't one of them.
He tells her it's good that she's there. And then we go directly to Paul talking to a therapist.
So this is the scene where like Bruce Willis really has to sell us on who this character is. And this thing falls flat.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing is like his dad used to beat him when he was a kid. And that kind of references back to in the earlier scene where his brother talked about how Paul was a scrappy kind of guy. And I guess that's what he was referring to, is he was always getting beat by his dad and running off. And he would spend time just riding the L train. And we get shots of Bruce Willis bored on the L train. Bruce Willis is just like, did I miss my stop? Am I a stop? Bruce Willis is just, his face is completely blank. It's not even like he's pained or anything like that. The grief or sorrow, there's nothing there. He's just riding the L train, maybe with a little bit of heartburn.
How many takes do you think Eli Roth had to do?
They shot with Bruce Willis on that train till like 2 a.m.
So they did multiple.
They did a lot of shit on that train. They did a lot of shit in Chicago. And that was the bulk of it. There's a few shots of him in the city. I think later on, there's a shot of him like taking a cell phone call, like somewhere in famous in Chicago. And that was there, but a lot of it was riding the L train. But yeah, that's whole, this whole sequence is he just has a monologue that is delivered with the intensity that makes Bruce Willis, that makes Harrison Ford's voiceover in Blade Runner seem energetic. Like, he really is just deadpanning every line here. Mm-hmm. I know I feel like a broken record about it, but once again, Willis is just almost DOA on this part.
There's a therapist Paul montage that goes on for a bit.
Yeah, we're seeing how he deals with the day-to-day. And there's a few nice segments here. I like him looking at the segment of the carpet where the blood was earlier and they just cut it out.
Yeah.
He can't stop staring at it. These are neat ideas, but the movie doesn't really dwell on that because the movie doesn't really care about that.
Paul goes to see the detective on his case. The detective seems pretty lazy.
Yeah, this is Dean Norris again. And
he basically tells Paul to have faith.
The detective doesn't really get much of a character. I mean, he has like a gluten allergy, or he's trying not to eat gluten, or diet, basically, is what's going on yeah. this whole movie. And that's the what Ocho had the cold, I think, in the other movie. And so that's kind of whatever. Yeah, we just get a scene about how there's nothing Kersey can do and the cops are trying, but it's just taking time. There's this big whiteboard of like all these cases that aren't closed. It's supposed to show you that the system doesn't work.
Yeah. We go from there to Paul getting his ass kicked by two hooligans.
So this is his initial start to be like, I'm going to start death wishing. He sees somebody out there, just like a lady getting harassed, and he calls these guys out and they beat the living fuck out of him.
Yeah.
I kind of like, but this is the one thing I always hate is in a situation like that, man, you could be royally, royally like fucked up for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like if people are kicking you while you're on the ground and unable to defend yourself, like every now and then I'll see like a fight video on Reddit and like somebody will go down like limp and some guy will just get on top of him and punch him like three more times. Like, no, stop. You're going to kill him.
Yeah.
You know, and I always think of that when I see these in movies, people always pull up so the hero has a chance. And I'm like, in real life, people stomp you until you might have brain damage. That was a dumb thing for Kersey to do with the way he did it. And at least he gets his ass kicked. When he comes home, he just uses the power of like frozen peas and ice packs to heal himself.
Yeah. He's a surgeon.
Yeah. He knows what to do. Yeah. Finish each other's sentences.
That's why we're married.
Love ya.
He watches a gun commercial and immediately heads to a gun store. Jerks off to her.
I mean, no, he...
yeah, he's all about it. Sexually pleases him.
We talked a little bit earlier about Chekhov's gun. Remember we talked about this the other day?
Yeah.
Is this Chekhov's furniture?
Yeah.
Because it shows a piece of furniture that has a hidden gun compartment where you can store an automatic weapon, right? It shows that. And the second I remember I saw that, I thought like, okay, well, that will clearly come back into play later. So he goes to the gun store and there's this girl.
Bethany,
who's very Tommy Lauren.
Yeah.
And she's real excited about guns. And hey, listen, that's cool. And she just kind of gives him the lowdown on what they are. She's like, she knows he's a first time buyer. And Bruce Willis, you can tell he's beginning to become erect at the idea of owning a firearm and killing others with it. But the legal ramifications of such put just the cold water on his murder boner.
Yeah, like he wants to go and kill immediately.
Yeah, and then she says something like, oh, we'll set you up with a gun safe so the bullets can be traced back to you in case someone steals your gun.
Yeah.
And it's like, nope, nope.
The next scene is Paul hiding a gun from a gunshot victim in his trauma unit.
So once again.
So that's how he gets his gun.
The hospital will just be this convenient plot device.
Yeah.
And listen, I listen to the commentary track because I hate myself. No, because I love you guys and I want to be prepared for the show. And Eli Roth was defending this bit. And immediately, as it came up, and I could hear how defensive Roth was about this, I could tell there were probably a number of like comment cards at screenings that said this was stupid. But apparently this is something that does happen to ER doctors, is they'll be moving a patient and clearing him or trying to like, you know, check for wounds, and he'll have like a big knife or like a gun will just be on him that nobody got off of him because they were concerned about saving his life.
Yeah.
It is something that does occur. According to Eli Roth, I didn't check this with any ER surgeons because I wasn't going to go that far, but that I just wanted to mention, it does seem pretty stupid and it does look pretty stupid that the gun just falls. He kicks it away. And so he magically has his murder weapon.
And if we hear from a paramedic out there, they can email us at grittyrebootcast@gmail.com.
That's right. You look us up, Gritty Reboot, on Instagram or TikTok, and you let us know if that doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
If you'd have been like, of course we're going to check him for a weapon. What, am I an idiot? So let me know, and I will call out Eli Roth on Twitter, and he will ignore me, as he has always done. Bitch.
Well, he takes the gun home, and he watches videos on the gun, and there's a gun montage, loading and unloading, and shots and gunshot victims. and then Paul's back at the hospital.
Yeah, yeah. So he learns a little bit about the weapon, and it's kind of, he watches YouTube videos, what I think is kind of interesting parallel about how things work today. Instead of going to like a real gun range, he just watches YouTube videos, and he shoots at a sign in an abandoned parking lot somewhere in Chicago, mm-hmm. I guess, some fantasy land where no one hears him shooting a gun.
He goes back to the hospital and notices his daughter's in restraint from having seizures.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, I think, what pushes him over the edge. At least you're led to believe so. Bruce Willis kind of gives this whole speech about, like, my daughter's in handcuffs and the animal that did this is out there walking free. But once again, Bruce Willis can't find that intensity or just didn't bother to do a third take. So, which I think is probably more
also,
B than A.
You know, for a surgeon who is supposed to be like the top surgeon in the hospital, wouldn't you be on call like nonstop, even like at nighttime? He has a lot of free time for that.
Well, remember, he's off because he can't do any surgeries for a bit.
Yeah, he's...
Yeah, he can't do any surgeries. I don't think it's till after like the first killing when he starts getting really into it that he can go back and do surgeries again.
Yeah, it's his time in this movie is just all weird.
It really it's is. It really wonky. Is. He's not a very busy surgeon is the key fact to take away.
Well, Paul goes looking for trouble and finds it. He gets shot and then shoots down a car coming towards
him. There is a carjacking that he does try to stop. So he does stumble upon violence. Yeah. He's not really, I mean, he is kind of looking for it, but he does find it. And so he takes a couple of shots and he gets, what is it, a Beretta's kiss?
Yeah, he gets shot and then another person gets shot and then he shoots a guy point blank.
Yeah, yeah. The Beretta catches him and cuts his hand, picks his gun up, but he's still able to fend him off. And there's a viral video of somebody filming. They catch him killing the guy point blank and finishing off the guys in the van or in the SUV.
Yeah, he runs and gets on the subway. He goes home and cleans his injured hand and tries to get some sleep. The detectives show up at the crime scene, and there's a video of the crime. They notice Paul hurt his hand.
Which automatically leads them to believe he doesn't have a lot of experience with weapons.
And then Paul sees himself online. And this is where we get the vigilante talk by Sway.
Yeah, we come back to the DJs again. Mancow and Sway are going to talk about the impact of the Reaper on the city.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's given the name here, the Reaper. Paul was able to get some sleep finally, and that was one thing he talked to the therapist about, not being able to sleep.
Yeah.
So killing is making him better, which is kind of an idea of the film, but the movie doesn't really run
go
anywhere.
It's
kind of present.
Goes nowhere controversial.
It's kind of present for a little bit, but it doesn't really add to anything, honestly.
I think I would have appreciated if they would have leaned into the right ring pop propaganda whole aspect.
Yeah.
I would have respected the movie more. But they don't do anything.
I mean, I was hoping for one of these movies where it goes that way and then he realizes he kills an innocent person.
Yeah.
Like that, I would love a little conflict in this movie, like where it's not just like
something.
Rah, rah. And it doesn't bother me on the Bronson version. He was waiting for people to rob him. This one's a little bit different. Like he's going out and like looking for people.
Bronson was sexually attracted to people robbing him.
Yeah, looking to mug him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he needed the mugging to engage first before he could attack. Those were the rules of Bronson. And this movie is a little bit different since he's a little bit more of just a pure vigilante.
He sees all the news and podcasts and YouTube shows talking about his crime.
He's loving it.
He's back at the hospital and seeing a patient that's a little boy who gets shot in the ankle.
And once again, the plot comes right into Bruce Willis again.
By the ice cream man.
And this isn't bad, actually. Bruce Willis isn't great here, but the idea of the scene is fine. And he hears about this kid that gets shot in the leg by a piece of shit drug dealer.
Yeah, the kid tells him all about it. So he goes after the ice cream man, and he shoots him in cold blood.
Right in the light of day, he just goes over there and just, who are you? I'm your last customer, and just guns him down. And by the way, it is hilarious that when he walks away, that everybody comes and like takes the guy's drugs and runs off.
I imagine that would be.
Yeah, that was a great touch. I really love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really love that. It was one of the few things that made me smirk.
So like we talked about earlier, it's not the vigilante this time. It's the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, they give him a little bit better name, the Grim Reaper.
Better name. News and podcasts and YouTube channel news are back. They make their commentary. Paul sees his therapist and she notices he's doing well considering.
Yeah, this is the most life.
Life not too long ago.
This is the most life Bruce Willis really shows in the movie where she's like, keep it up. Yeah, I will. Literally, that's the most life he shows in the film.
Yeah.
That one line that's in every trailer.
Paul's back at work again, and he takes care of a patient that had his watch on. And this is where we go to a completely different part of the movie.
So literally, the plot walks back into the hospital.
Yeah.
Because without this element, we will not be able to tie him back to the original killers.
Mm-hmm.
Which the first movie doesn't do. And that's sort of whatever. It's because the book didn't do it, I guess, and that's why they didn't do it there. This one tries to correct that, and you know, because that's something, a narrative that you sort of do want. It was pretty half-assed how it's just shoehorned in. The guy just walks into the hospital that Bruce Willis is at, and he happens to see his watch on his arm.
Yeah, so he goes, and the guy dies, and yeah. He takes his phone, and
we don't know why he died, we don't know what happened.
Yeah.
It's not important. Fuck that guy. He's just there to get us to the third act of this movie.
He goes and opens his phone with his fingerprint and steals back his watch. He sees pictures of his address the guy took from earlier.
So he starts putting it all together.
Yeah.
He's like the world's greatest detective now.
And then Paul goes to a bar looking for a guy. He's hunting for clues in the people that hurt his wife. So he's at a bar and he stabs the guy in the hand with a dart and then holds a gun to him, forcing him to give his shit back to him.
Yeah, yeah. This scene's okay.
Yeah, that's not bad.
It's a little silly how it gets all started, but this is one of the movie's bigger, like, kind of action scenes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Weirdly enough, and it's not really a ton of action.
But Paul gets ambushed by another guy. And the bar guy gets shot in the head.
Yeah, this is the bowling ball pit, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, basically, Kersey doesn't really handle the situation very well. He kind of handles it like an asshole and an idiot, and just gets lucky at the end of the sequence that the guy ends up getting hit in the head with a bowling ball and drops right into him for a kill shot.
Yeah, they shoot at each other. Paul shoots him one more time, and he goes down and tells Paul who killed his wife. His name is Joe. The guy who killed his wife. He shoots Paul and goes to finish him off, and a bowling ball falls on his head. Then he somehow shoots himself.
It's like a pure Home Alone bit.
Very Home Alone stuff.
Yeah, you know, and oddly enough, I think the shootout inside, like, where all the stuff is kind of all right. There's a nice sequence in there where, like, Willis is, like, using the monitors to see the actions going on outside. So that's pretty well put together, and he knocks a guy out with a guitar, I guess. That's okay. And then it ends really with this. When he gets the information he needs, he's completely undone by his ineptitude. And like I said, the bowling ball comes down Home Alone style and just saves him, I guess.
Yep.
It's not very satisfying, you know, in the least. He drops his ring on the way out. So we have another connection to the story to move on.
We have more conservative rhetoric about the Grim Reaper and the detectives come and see Paul. And let them know they found one of the guys who may have had something to do with his wife and daughter's attack.
So for these DJ segments here, it is very important to note that Eli Roth didn't give them any direction at all. He just sort of said what had just occurred in the movie, the plot to some extent, and just said, all right, just kind of riff about it as if it was real. So he didn't give them any political direction one way or the other or how to feel about the events of the film.
Mm-hmm.
He just sort of let them go. And that's another thing I wanted to mention about Eli Roth sort of not really caring about that element of the film, even though it's there.
Yeah.
Like that wasn't.
It's a prominent element of the film.
It's just something he wasn't particularly interested in. That was what he wanted to do with that element, was just let those guys handle it and he make an exploitation revenge movie, which isn't even very good at that.
Well, Paul ends up finding Joe and knocks him out. When he wakes up, he's under a car that is hovering above him.
So he hits him in the nuts with like a wrench, right?
Yeah.
Like a big ass wrench. And like he hits his head on the muffler and knocks himself out. And this is a little bit of the Roth touch because he is tied up underneath his vehicle and the jack is suspended above him. And Kersey uses his surgeon's knowledge, which kind of reminded me of like Glass House on the Left a little bit. That was the original ending for that one, is the surgeon was going to come in and be like, "Ha, I know where your arteries are and I can cut perfectly." And the end, they just did it with a fucking chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, they go back to his medical training and he cuts along his leg to expose a nerve. And then he pours brake fluid in the nerve.
Yeah.
Which, as they were told on set, is the most painful thing you can experience without going into cardiac arrest. And I think I delivered that line with more gusto than Bruce Willis did.
Well, he ends up giving up Knox, who is a part of his family's attack. So probably the main guy.
This is kind of wicked. I do like him pouring the brake fluid. I think the actor is a little cheesy about how he goes on about it. And once again, Bruce Willis does not care.
No.
Which sucks because the trailer line is in this scene, right?
Yeah. And then he he takes a chain that is attached to the jack.
You're not going to kill me.
I'm not going to kill you.
He says a very cheesy line.
Jack
smushes Joe's head.
Pulls the chain off the jack and it comes. And the head smush is pretty cool. But once again, Bruce Willis doesn't put any charisma at all on this line.
I couldn't even get into it.
I mean, like, you know, we were just laughing earlier. Like, I think it was a lot of fun. You know, Bronson just like, do you believe in Jesus? Well, you're going to meet him. You know, like that. You know, there's a sense of fun to that that's just not really there in this version. Like, Bruce Willis is just trying to get back to his trailer.
The detectives question Uncle Frank, and then a 49-year-old copycat killer gets shot by a mugger per the
copy vigilante.
Yeah.
Which barely any attention is focused on that. It's just supposed to be like a half-assed fake out to tell you that Paul might have gotten killed, but nobody would fall for it. There's sadly still more death wish left to go.
Paul Kersey gets called by Knox.
So yeah, Knox just fucking delivers the third act of the film.
He tells them where they can meet.
Yeah, he's like, we got to meet up or else I'll tell the police what's up. And Bruce Willis is like, I guess. You know, because his daughter is, you know, he doesn't really care. His daughter's still in a coma.
Yeah.
So he's just like, yeah, sure, what the hell. So he wanders off into a scene from almost an entirely different film.
Uncle Frank goes to see Paul and he doesn't answer the door. So he lets himself in.
Oh, did you talk about him with the detectives?
Not yet.
Oh, is that later? Okay. That's right. Yeah.
He goes there. No down into there. The basement where he sees Paul's den of guns and a mess everywhere.
Yeah. And he's able to put it together that Paul's the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
Or just he's really into his man cave.
Paul goes to find Knox and they have a shootout in the bathroom at a club.
Yeah. And this is just wild nonsense. Like, he just starts shooting randomly into, like, a stall, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you don't know who's in there?
Yeah.
And this whole scene is really that way. There's just kind of, like, random shooting, and then Bruce Willis just shoots a generator, which is in the bathroom.
He just wounds Knox and takes a shot himself.
Yeah, and then he hits the lights, basically. The convenient off switch was inside the bathroom stall he was in. And so he's able to knock out lights to the entire place. And then slowly, the oldest man in the place slowly walks out undetected, bleeding.
Yeah. Detectives get the call and head out. Knox witnesses the Grim Reaper, so the cops are all over him. And then we see Paul stapling his own shoulder wound. So
yeah, he has a metal self-surgery scene.
He knows what to do.
Since he's a doctor.
Frank confronts Paul about what he's been doing. And this is where
this is their weakest scene together.
And Frank leads them away.
This is their weakest scene together where he's like, somebody's got to do it. And like Bruce Willis is really checked out here. And D'Onofrio isn't even at his best during the scene. Mm-mm. So whatever happened to Willis, they infected D'Onofrio here too. But the detectives come because they've obviously figured this out from Knox. Knox has told them who the Grim Reaper is.
Yeah.
But they need proof.
Jordan is awake and Paul.
By the way, but Kersey ducks talking to the cops.
Yeah.
Only his brother does. Let me ask you, did you at any point, think his brother was going to be dirty?
Mm-mm.
You never thought that?
Mm-mm.
I really thought that was going to be like a twist at one point.
I thought he was like a gambler or something because he obviously owed his brother money.
I thought that was going to be the twist. It was going to be like they robbed his house to pay back his gambling debts or something. And that's why. Or like he was in charge. They didn't have any personal connection. Why is he here? They added this brother character. What the fuck is he here for?
I guess he's just really close to his brother.
But he doesn't do anything in the story.
No.
He's literally a red herring for the detectives because we know who the goddamn Grim Reaper is. He's just there for that purpose and someone for Kersey to talk to at random points, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is no other purpose to this character. The economy of actors, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I thought he was going to have more to be a part of. Instead, the movie doesn't have a real bad. I guess Knox is the bad guy, but we don't even see his face until 3/4 of the way through the film.
Yeah.
So the movie has no antagonist other than crime and liberals.
Jordan is awake and Paul goes to the hospital to see her. Paul tells Frank it's over. He's done. But this movie's got to come to an end.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, he's like, my daughter's healthy. I want to leave this behind. And unlike the other film where it feels like this is something that's just a part of Bronson or a part of Paul Kersey, like, you can tell at this point, he's like, okay, once I'm done with this is over. I just need to beat the final level and I'm done.
The detectives come and meet Paul and Jordan is being discharged. Knox is in the elevator with Paul and Jordan.
This scene isn't bad. I kind of like that there's a little bit of a threatening nature to it, even if it is a little bit too overt.
And then Paul goes back to the gun store to buy a gun finally.
So yeah, he finally buys legal guns, and this is like the right-wing fantasy.
Yes.
This whole ending sequence, which sadly isn't a great action sequence. It's okay, but it's not particularly impressive.
Paul, Frank, and Jordan have dinner, then Frank leaves. Paul suddenly puts Jordan in a hiding spot and tells her to call the police.
Did he make that hiding spot before this?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to have made that just fresh. He didn't. That wasn't there at the house, right? No. Okay.
Yeah, because he added a bunch of shit.
Yeah.
Knox and crew break in. They shoot up the place. Paul kills one, then kills another quickly.
So one guy just walks into the bathroom without checking anyway, and he just takes him out, shoots him in the head. Mm-hmm. And then Kersey dives under the bed. We don't see this, but this is the logistics of the situation. He dives under the bed, comes to a complete stop, and puts his hand just outside the bed to where that corpse is at, right beside his arm, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he can pick up the automatic weapon to surprise us, the audience, and the other killer who entered the room. It doesn't really make a lot of sense when you lay it out like that, but that's just how it works, I guess.
Paul goes back to look for Knox and gets shot in the arm.
Yeah.
He shoots Knox with an assault rifle.
This is the furniture bit.
Yeah.
Knox gets him, corners him. Knox is talking shit. He's about to finish him off. And Kersey's in deep shit. He's bleeding. And bam, he hits the button on the furniture. The automatic weapon pops. I don't know what kind of gun it is. He grabs it and he takes out Knox, kills him, saves the day.
The police come and basically write the whole thing off. It's like an NRA wet dream, the whole sequence.
Yeah.
He sends his daughter off to college and gives the finger to guns to a random minority he thinks is a criminal.
Yeah, I see some guy, I think, like steal like a suitcase or something. And then he does the Charles Bronson shot from the end of the first movie.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look as cool. But that's it. That is Death Wish 2018. Is there subtext here? Not particularly. Mm-mm. It's just a movie that's an exploitation. They got an exploitation director to make this movie. He wasn't really interested in that sort of political subtext. And I think that's a real shame because I think this movie really could have leaned into some of those ideas to be a little edgy and to maybe make this something memorable. But it's completely forgettable as it is. And even without any controversy the film had by shifting release dates or even by some of the gun control issues that popped up from the movie's narrative, it doesn't matter because it's just crummy. It's a lousy remake of a film that wasn't that great to start.
Well, my facts here are about as interesting as Bruce Willis's performance.
Yeah.
That didn't have much on this movie.
Yeah, there's not really a whole lot. I think the pre-production of the film was probably more interesting than anything else.
Eli Roth met a Chicago musician, Chance the Rapper, before shooting to discuss violence in Chicago and talk about possibly collaborating on the film musically. Although the collaboration did not happen, Chance's brother Taylor Bennett appears in the opening montage of radio calls, talking with Sway in the Morning about violence in Chicago.
That is kind of interesting.
Can you guess all the actors that were considered for the role of Paul Kersey? You already named one earlier.
Okay, we got Arnold Schwarzenegger. No, that's not right.
No.
Liam Neeson, I know, was one.
Yep.
Harrison Ford was briefly considered.
Nope.
The Undertaker?
Nope.
Nah, they didn't get Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Russell Crowe.
No.
Matt Damon.
No, too young.
Benicio del Toro.
That could have worked, but yeah, that could have worked.
Will Smith.
That, you know what? Actually, making Paul Kersey black could have
been
really
fine.
Yeah, really would have helped out with a lot of your race issues. You wouldn't have had to worry
Brad
about that.
Pitt.
That could have worked too. I can see that. He wouldn't have done it.
No.
I mean, if Quentin Tarantino was making it, then yes, but.
Yeah.
But Tarantino wouldn't have called it Death Wish.
It was also originally set to star Sylvester Stallone, but Stallone backed out after creative differences and to work on other projects.
He wanted to make Stop from a Mumble Shoot. No, and it's a different thing. That was in the 2010s. He was probably, I don't know, Rocky Balboa, probably around that era.
Charles Bronson was considered for the role of John McClane in Die Hard, but he was under contract with the Cannon Group, Inc. at the time, so the part went to Bruce Willis.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I knew you'd like that fact.
Yeah. It was originally an older character, so I guess that makes sense.
All right. So the reviews on this movie, 4.1 in user review, 18% on Rotten Tomatoes, 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb. And I know you're not shocked. There's always somebody that's going to like these shit movies, and that's how other shit movies get made.
I went through it on YouTube, and I found some really conservative channels that just fucking orgasmed about this movie. And I'm like, this movie? Really?
The review is called Wonderfully Entertaining Movie, Vincent D'Onofrio. Wow, genuine acting.
He's just a list of things. Image is flickering. Sound from speakers.
10 out of 10. Just watched this in the theater. We had so much fun. We all cheered for Paul Kersey to whoop some butt. Bruce Willis definitely has some cowboy credit with Die Hard under his belt. I had some very familiar feelings in some scenes in The Death Wish. He's back. Eli Roth has done it again. This movie hits home with a lot of people. We all ride the bus, the subway, trains. We see the underside of the city. Most people don't dare to go. True life. Nobody is safe. And instead of rundown New York of the 70s, which was literally a war zone, we get to see modern-day Chicago. It was brilliant. So just like in Bronson's classic, the Grim Reaper, as the Chicago radio call him, get revenge on the people that were involved and responsible for in his wife's death and daughter in a coma. He also just stops crime in the making, and in one scene goes to a neighborhood because the drug dealer shoots an innocent kid. I felt this movie wasn't about black or white or guns or no guns, but what about what's right and what's wrong? Everybody can get behind that. We need more movies like this. We also get to see some brutal death scenes. The theater gasped at almost everyone. Do you have any idea how hard that is to do nowadays? 10 stars, a great crime thriller without too much over-the-top gunplay and fantastic acting. Vincent D'Onofrio is great in this, such a genuine person. My girlfriend enjoyed this movie too, and she normally hates everything. I was shocked. Can't wait for the Blu-ray or 4K release of this. I just love that review.
Well, I'm glad he loved it. At least somebody out there is going to love this movie. By the way,
Baby Angel loved it.
I didn't mention the box office numbers. A $30 million budget brings in just under $50 million. So it makes a little bit of profit, but you're looking to really double your money.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about like marketing costs and actually just, you know, opening a movie in theaters costs money. So this movie, like I said, it wasn't an absolute failure, but I'm pretty sure it was a lot less than what they were hoping for.
Yeah. I hated it, and I never want to see it again.
Yeah, I'll probably never watch this one again. I may watch the original film one more time, but these are two movies I may never really see again. And that's okay. Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah, I think I'm good with that.
Yeah, this one's fine. If I never saw the other one, well, okay, I guess.
I'm sure
there's an opportunity where I'll watch the original Death Wish one more time. Unless we go back and revisit this episode, or unless they reboot Death Wish again, I don't think I'll ever watch this Bruce Willis film again, nor will it ever be on cable.
Mm-hmm.
Watch is probably on like FX right now or something. Actually, it's on TNT.
Well, with that, bid you farewell.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Bye.